Many, many years ago, when I directed a program called the Intergovernmental Executive Development Program for the Office of the Mayor, we'd always start the first session by having this gentleman's father come in and talk to us about Chicago history. His name was Herman Cogan. And if you've ever read books like Give the Lady What She Wants and Hinky Dink and Bathhouse John, you know what I'm talking about. But we have with us today one of the great writers and people who really understands the city of Chicago. We eagerly look forward to reading his column every time it appears in the Tribune. And he's going to introduce Kevin Bell. Rick Cogan, let's give him a round of applause.
It's always nice to hear my father's name mentioned. How many of you in this room have never been to Lincoln Park Zoo? What is wrong with you? Did you just get out of a long prison stint, did you? How many of you in this room are not running for mayor of the city of Chicago? That'll change. It is actually such a treat. Kevin has been a friend of mine for a very, very long time, and it's a special treat to be here without the heavy shadow of politics and political promises hanging in this room. In all the campaigns I've ever heard from people running for the mayor of this great city, I have never, and I listen closely, heard any of them mention Lincoln Park Zoo as one of the jewels, not just a jewel of this city, but an essential thread in the fabric of this city. The zoo is celebrating its 150th anniversary this year, starting with two swans, which Kevin will tell you about. Even though he didn't know them, he has been there almost, almost a third of that time. He's been here for 42 years, started as the youngest curator in the history of the zoo. And unlike a lot of politicians, he didn't pay to get the job as president. And those of you, all of you except you, strange person over here who's never been to the zoo, have seen that zoo transform. I've been going there since I was born, which is quite some time ago, which is actually almost half the length of the zoo, and seen it change in ways that the average visitor would not really notice, seen it change in ways that are important not just for our enlightenment, but for all the animals who are cared for there. This guy's the real deal. I'm going to tell you, he may elaborate. He was born to do this because when his dad, who was a curator of birds at the Bronx Zoo, Kevin Bell, lived in the zoo. He has old, fabulous, remember things called newspapers, everybody? Remember those things? These fabulous headlines with pictures of little Kevin, the boy with 2,800 pets. I give you now the man who has made the zoo as important a place in this city as there is, Kevin Bell.
Thank you, Rick, and thank you, all of you, for coming today. I'm going to start with an apology, and this is hopefully won't become apparent, but this is my first day talking after having a cold that I came down with last week. So I have a pocket full of cough drops. I've got a bottle of water, and hopefully I will get through without a coughing fit. If something starts, my trusty number two, Megan Ross, will be ready to pop up here and finish the talk for me, but hopefully we'll be okay. So it is an honor to be here. I love talking about Lincoln Park Zoo. You know, it dawned on me when I was first asked, and they said, well, talk about the 150 years of the zoo, and you've got about 15 minutes. So that means I've got about 1 minute to cover every 10 years of Lincoln Park Zoo, which I won't bore you with all those early details, but focus a little bit more on maybe a little bit more of the recent activities at the zoo. But let me start by, I hope many of you saw 60 Minutes last night and saw, again, Megan Ross and some of our staff talking a little bit about what a modern zoo is about. And it is about science. It's about using science in many ways that, as Rick said, when I grew up at the Bronx Zoo, we really didn't know. We did a lot of things just what we thought was best, but they weren't backed up by data. And these days, fortunately, we use science in all parts of our operation. And it's led to, I think, better animal welfare. It's led to better visitor service and a visitor experience. So we'll get into that a little bit more a little bit down the road. But first, let me maybe go back in time and tell you a little bit about how Lincoln Park Zoo started. And I'll quickly go through those early years. Let me just finish, though, with one comment, because I don't want to forget this at the end. You know, Rick asked, so I'm glad all of you have been to Lincoln Park Zoo. What you may not realize is that Lincoln Park Zoo is the only privately managed free zoo in the United States. So that's a pretty big deal. And I actually, you know, Rick was talking about politicians, City Hall. That's something that every mayor that I've known in Chicago has been a staunch supporter of. It's something our Board of Trustees is wedded to, and it is something that I don't think will ever change. So that's a wonderful thing for Chicago. And it's a wonderful thing for all of us that work there, because we had 3.7 million visitors last year. That's an incredible opportunity to impact kids that come to the zoo as well as adults and let them learn a little bit more about the animals in our care, about conservation, about so many different things that we're doing at both at Lincoln Park Zoo and around the world. So how did we start? And I appreciate my staff made notes for me, because when I stand up and start talking about the zoo, it can go on for a long time. So they've really got me down to making sure this leaves enough time for questions at the end. So where did it start? And, you know, you see the picture of the swans up there. I'm not sure if those were the original swans. Not those are mute swans, which are actually an introduced species here in the United States. But the funny part of the story of starting with a gift of two swans, or four swans, actually, back in 1868, is that when I came to Lincoln Park Zoo in 1976, our tagline was, "We were America's oldest zoo." Kind of sad at that point that we didn't have anything better to talk about than saying we were old, but you know, fortunately that's changed. But it's interesting, the Philadelphia Zoo, their tagline was America's first zoo. So they actually had property but no animals. We had these swans, but really didn't have the property. Does it really matter? And if you think about it, where did these swans come from? They came from Central Park. So, you know, it all really doesn't matter all that much. But it's kind of interesting when you think back to those early days and how the zoo developed. So it started with this gift of swans. And then it led to, back around the you know, the beginning of the 1900s, it began with a series of buildings that were built. And it's, you know, Lincoln Park is a unique zoo, being an urban zoo with a lot of historic landmark buildings located on the zoo grounds. So, for example, here Bridget actually just sent me a text. She wasn't able to make it today, but this was the first aquarium in the city of Chicago. And it actually was the aquarium until the Shedd Aquarium opened up, and then the fish were moved over to the Shedd. It became our reptile house, and now it's primarily our main food service at the zoo. So we have a lot of these old historic buildings, which are a blessing for us. They're beautiful, beautiful architecture, wonderful buildings. they're also a little bit of a curse for us. And that is, excuse me, so it's starting, that is that the exhibits that were designed back in those early days, animal welfare and animal behavior wasn't necessarily the topmost in people's minds when they were building these buildings. So if you look at the historic Lion House, for example, beautiful, big public space with the arched ceiling and then the very tiny animal spaces. So our challenge going forward was taking these buildings that were these turn-of-the-century, beautiful, architecturally designed buildings and converting them into something that was actually good for the animals. So a little bit more about that later on. So in addition to the buildings, we also had some pretty famous animals that lived at Lincoln Park. This is Bushman, who was before my time. Sinbad was actually the big male gorilla when I came to Lincoln Park Zoo in the 1970s. But Bushman was certainly an icon in Chicago. Having left Lincoln Park Zoo, went to the Field Museum of Natural History. Interesting story. John McCarter tried to give him back at one point in time to me. He thought it would be great to bring Bushman back to the zoo. And I said, no, we're happy with our live animals. Thank you. Thank you very much. And then, you know, in addition to the animals, we had some pretty famous people that worked at Lincoln Park as well. So I don't know if many of you are aware that Marlon Perkins actually started his career at Lincoln Park. And it was Marlon who, back in the 1950s, actually brought zoos into everybody's home with the first sort of zoo show called Zoo Parade. And it was a very, very popular show that was filmed around the zoo. Marlon became a national star. I remember I was at the Economic Club one night, and I was sitting with Les Fisher, and Newt Gingrich was the speaker. And Newt started out his conversation by saying, I love coming to Chicago. I love it because it's got such great cultural institutions. It's got two zoos, and it's got a great aquarium. It's absolutely fantastic. And he said, I learned to love zoos because I watched Marlon Perkins in the basement of the Reptile House at Lincoln Park Zoo, you know. And I was sitting next to Les Fisher, and he was just beaming. He was just so pleased, you know, to hear these stories. Because back in the 50s, Les was our veterinarian, and he worked with Marlon on a lot of these shows. There's Les as veterinarian and later as zoo director. And Les served, as you see, zoo director from 1962 until 1992. Marlon actually became such a big personality that he ended up bumping heads with some other egos in Chicago and decided it was best to go to St. Louis. So Marlon had started St. Louis, went back to the St. Louis Zoo as director, and then did things like Wild Kingdom. Les at Lincoln Park Zoo didn't do Zoo Parade, but continued other shows that if you grew up in Chicago, sort of in my age bracket, you had Ark in the Park, the Ray Rayner Show, Bozo Circus, all those things that Les continued to do at Lincoln Park Zoo. We as staff used to help prepare for those shows, and it was actually a lot of fun. It was also interesting. Ray Rayner was terrified of animals, so you always had to pick animals that weren't going to jump on him or do anything that came close to him. So it was sort of one of those interesting things that you had to sort of plan everything out. But Les was a great mentor and a great boss. And when I did come from the Bronx Zoo, the director of the Bronx Zoo at the time said, "You know, Lincoln Park Zoo is a great city zoo, but led by a great director," and he was oh so right. Les Fisher was a second father to me, and what a great mentor, what a great person for the city of Chicago, and he really is the one who brought the zoo, laid all the groundwork for the zoo being what it is today. So, let's see. So that was actually just a shot of our first ape house. So when I came to the zoo in 76, we were in construction of the first capital campaign that the Zoo Society, which had started in the late 50s, developed. And the Great Ape House, which was later named the Lester Fisher Great Ape House, opened up in 1976. And as bird curator, one of my first duties was going and hanging ropes so that the great apes could swing through the different exhibits. Then kind of moving on, in after Les's term was, I'm not quite sure why the bird curator shot is up there, but moving on from Les's term to my term, I actually was asked to replace Les in 1992, and I turned the job down, and I did it, I thought, for a very, very good reason. That is, I loved being a curator. Curators nowadays in modern zoos are traveling all around the world, working on conservation science projects. You cannot imagine a better experience and a better occupation. So I turned the job down. Another person was hired. He only lasted about 10 months, And then they came back and asked me again, and I said at that point in time, I thought, I knew I could do at least as bad a job as he was doing. And so I took the job, and actually, you know, if those of you who have been around a long time, you know, it's a lot easier to replace somebody who didn't do well rather than trying to replace a legend. So for me, it actually worked out really, really well. But 1 month after I started, which was June of 1993, as director, the mayor's office called and said, we want to privatize Lincoln Park Zoo. And now I was a bird curator. I was been working in Indonesia and Iceland and other places. To be honest with you, I didn't really understand what privatization even meant. It was a great awakening for me to try and all of a sudden understand what it costs to run the zoo. So many of our costs were actually buried in a park district budget because we were a department within the Chicago Park District. So it took us about a year and a half to figure out, okay, can we make this work? Is there a good business model out there? And keep the zoo free at the same time. So we actually came to agreement basically the day after Thanksgiving. Not surprising that the city wanted to make the announcement on probably the slowest news day, I guess, probably that there is. And it was contingent upon us signing the agreement before January 1st of 1995. Well, we did in fact sign that agreement at 10:30 p.m. on December 31st, 1994, and we took over the zoo an hour and a half later. I still remember it snowed that night, and I was trying to figure out, uh-oh, now I got to plow the zoo, because the park district always did that for us. So it's sort of one of those experiences that you kind of, okay, we weren't expecting. But the turning of the zoo over to the Lincoln Park Zoo Society was probably the greatest event that has ever happened to Lincoln Park Zoo. Because what that allowed us to do was to really focus on the programmatic areas of the zoo rather than just on the physical structure itself. Park District primarily a recreation facility. That's their job. And so it was always a fun place to come to Lincoln Park Zoo, but there weren't a lot of programs that backed it up. So our task when we started really was, hey, this is a great opportunity to grow our education, our learning programs, our community engagement programs, our conservation and science programs, as well as our animal welfare programs. So we started out in education early on with sort of building our learning department. Up on the screen here, you see just one of the team programs that we have right now, and Bridget may have talked about this when she was here because they have a similar program at the Shed. This is our Conservation Ambassador Board. These are teams from across the city that actually work to help us develop programs for other teens in the city. So rather than us older folks sitting around in a room and developing these programs, we have actually the kids design programs for themselves. And these are really, really sharp kids. And they also participate. They come, they act as a board. We're going to actually have them at our board meeting coming up in June. So they'll be there participating in the board. And they've been an incredible asset for our learning programs. Community engagement is something that's relatively new to us. We've always had some outreach. We had, you know, our old traveling zoo that went out into the neighborhoods in the past. But a couple years ago, we got a grant actually from the Pritzker Foundation that started us thinking about, okay, how can we do this one better than just going out and having a program or assuming we know what the communities wanted. So we spent actually quite a bit of time using the Pritzker Foundation money to go out and talk to some of the community members to try and figure out what is it that they want. Do they want access to the zoo? Do they want free transportation to the zoo? What is it they want? And what we found was they really wanted programs in their communities. They wanted to come to the zoo too, but they wanted us to have a presence in their community so that after school they had things they could participate in. The first community we picked was Little Village in Chicago, the part of the city of Chicago with the least amount of green space of any community in the city of Chicago. And so we worked with Little Village to develop the little green spaces they had to make them more aware of the environment around them, how they could use those green spaces to attract more wildlife, how we could make them better from a horticultural standpoint. And then we were able to work with them on other programs as well. We have actually a pretty large arts program right now with the Open Center of the Arts in Little Village. So that's just, I could talk about that for a long time because it's one of my favorite projects. But moving on to, I think conservation is the next piece. You know, one of the things that we started early on after we went private was trying to find out, you know, what was our niche? What could we do better than anybody else? And we started out with some ideas that seemed a little far-fetched at the time, but early on, we decided to hire a full-time epidemiologist at Lincoln Park Zoo. No zoo in the country had an epidemiologist. Well, why do you need one, right? Epidemiology is really the study of population health. And we were very interested, though, in zoonotic diseases, diseases that are shared by people as well as by animals, and their effect on conservation in places like Africa and Gombe National Park and other places. So we hired this epidemiologist kind of saying, okay, let's just try this and see if this concept works. Well, bad for the country, good for us. About 2 years after we hired the epidemiologist, West Nile virus broke out in New York City and spread like a wave across the United States from the East Coast to the West Coast. All of a sudden, our epidemiologist was in demand all across the country, going and talking about how you can deal with it, how you can make lessen the impact of West Nile virus, how you can try and control the mosquito populations, et cetera. It became so popular that the donors that gave us the money for epidemiology said, what do you want to do next? This is really exciting. And that just developed into then endocrinology and actually into the Urban Wildlife Institute, which is a little bit, I think, maybe on the next slide. I'll get to urban wildlife. So one of the things that was a legacy of Dr. Fisher's was the study of gorillas. That was one of the things I think that fascinated him as a veterinarian, was to learn more about the physiology of great apes. And so when we went private, we decided we would set up this center to really study great apes in a much larger sense. And we went out and got funds to set up the Fisher Center, which is an amazing center. I could talk about this one for the 20 minutes alone. It deals with chimp welfare. So actually, we have a staff member who's very, very involved with looking at chimps that were in private hands, chimps that are in entertainment, and chimps that have spent the majority of their lives in NIH labs, being injected with hepatitis and HIV and whatnot, and making their lives better going forward. We also do cognition work, but we also have a full-time staff member working in the Congo, working with logging companies to lessen the impact of logging on the wild populations of gorillas and chimps in Gulogo Triangle in Republic of Congo. So next is the Urban Wildlife Institute. Again, another one funded by the Davy Foundation. And this was the natural progression of some of our other centers. This was really looking at the impacts of animals and people in urban spaces. And we all know that living in the city of Chicago, it's tough for us even as humans to have a good quality of life sometimes. And think about what it is for the animals that use this area as well. So we really wanted to have our scientists look at how can we create this better harmony between humans and animals in public spaces, in urban areas. And so we developed Nature Boardwalk, which was originally a concrete pond within the Chicago Park District that we converted into a beautiful nature center just south of the zoo. And this is actually sort of the home base for the Urban Wildlife Institute, where we study the bird populations, invertebrate populations, fish, turtles, et cetera. And it's a great place for Chicago school kids to come out and learn about nature right in the city without having to go outside into the suburbs. So Urban Wildlife Institute has now grown into the Urban Wildlife Information Network. And we now have, I think, 11 partners around the United States. So cities that are signing up that want to be part of the urban wildlife, they do our science, they do all the procedures that we do, and we share the data. The goal for this is to help urban planning so that we can create better spaces and lessen the impact on migrating birds, for example, as they come through Chicago and other cities across the U.S. When you look at cities, it doesn't matter what city you're in. The species may be different. You may have an alligator problem in some cities in Florida, whereas you have, you know, beavers and you have coyotes in Chicago. But the problems are all basically the same. And how can we make that coexistence better? So one of the other things I think that was a dream of Dr. Fisher, back from when I started, Les always wanted to call Lincoln Park Zoo the Lincoln Park Zoological Gardens. But it really wasn't a gardens. It was a lot of mowed lawns. And that was what was easiest for the park district to maintain in those days. When we took over in 1995, we wanted to make a visual impact immediately so that when people come in, they could see this was a different operation than it was in the past. So the biggest way to do that was to change the look of the grounds. First of all, to make it a lot cleaner, but also replace a lot of the grass areas with beautiful gardens. And now that has developed to a point where we consider our horticulture department one of our sort of species management programs, so that our chief horticulturist is with us on a lot of our discussions when we talk about long-term planning, not only in terms of the physical nature of what it looks like on the zoo grounds, but in terms of the conservation of plants as well. Animal welfare is relatively recent. I think we've always been interested in animal welfare, but animal welfare has been a tough one for us over the years, us, when I say us, zoos and aquariums, to kind of measure. And how many of you saw the 60 Minutes thing last night? Did you see the zoo thing? Yeah, so we touched on that quite a bit. You know, one of the things that I'm really proud of that our staff developed was a program called Zoo Monitor, which is now being, I don't know, Megan, how many places around the globe have downloaded that? 250 institutions around the globe are now using basically the app that was developed at Lincoln Park Zoo. And what it does is it looks at animal welfare on a day-to-day basis. So, you know, and it, again, the show touched on it a little bit last night. You know, we're very concerned about individual animal welfare. The topic came up last night about population welfare versus individual welfare. And, you know, we have a commitment to every animal that is at Lincoln Park Zoo for the life of that animal. So you will not see culling at Lincoln Park Zoo. So just to put that to rest. But, you know, this is a tremendous tool that allows the staff and all the volunteers that collect this data to look day in and day out, day after day, at the same animals, and they can detect minor changes in how the animal's using the exhibit, how whether the animal's eating normally, all the little kind of details that may not be apparent to the visitors that come through. But then they can take all that data and feed it into the supercomputers and come up with really patterns that tell us more about the welfare of the individual animals within the exhibit. So, again, a great step forward in terms of not just for Lincoln Park Zoo, but for all zoos and aquariums around the country. So, you know, one of the things that I think is probably most difficult for me is, so when, you know, bird curating was fun, as I said, I was out romping around the world, and being a director is basically being a fundraiser. So it's not quite as glamorous as being a curator. But it's important work, and it involves raising money both to improve exhibits, but also to provide money for the programs that we want to do, and to maintain the care of the animals, especially in a free institution. So our most recent campaign is the Pride of the Zoo campaign, and it's really started out with what I think is one of the most successful exhibits we've ever had, which is Regenstein Macaque Forest. These are Japanese macaques, which, you know, one of the things we've tried to do is look at exhibits that are active year-round, because we're trying to get our visitorship throughout the year and not just focus on the busy summer months. Japanese macaques are a good temperate species. They stay out all year round. They're very active. Do an incredible amount of cognition. So we have a cognitive booth actually built into the exhibit so you can go there and watch science actually right in front of you. Not just read about it, but you can actually see the scientists doing their work at the Macaque Forest. Robert and Myra Pritzker Penguin Cove You might have seen a press release recently about a little baby penguin that we had recently. Oliver is his name. But again, this is a new exhibit for us. We had a penguin seabird building. I actually was there for both the construction and the demolition of the building over 30-something years. And we decided to go with a more temperate species of penguin, again, one that would do really well in a Chicago climate, both in the summertime as well as in winter. So these are African penguins, these South African penguins that are in this exhibit. And we also have our first sort of immersion kind of experience where you can go with your family and go behind the scenes and actually go in with the penguins. You have to make a reservation, but you can do that before your zoo visit. And then I think next will be Walter Family Arctic Tundra. This is our polar bear exhibit. So this is about triple the size of our former polar bear exhibit. So again, a lot of the data that we collect, a lot of the information about animal behavior and whatnot goes into the design of the exhibits. We knew that the classic zoo exhibit for polar bears was really a pool, right, with concrete edges, and polar bears like to swim, so you create this big pool. But by teaming up with conservationists and behaviorists in the wild, you learn more about that these bears love to scratch around in the dirt and really use a lot of the habitat, not just the water part of it. Matter of fact, it got to be just a little bit of a problem for me last week, as Maureen knows, as she's smiling right now, because our two polar bears, Siku and Tellini, and Tellini's our female, came in, and we have seen breeding, and it was in front of the public, so it's not a secret. So we're hoping, fingers crossed, that there will be good results there. But Tellini, as Maureen has told me, likes to now roll around in the mud. And then she likes to clean herself off by jumping in the pool. So I was walking through the zoo one morning, and I got to the Walter Family polar bear exhibit, and there was a completely muddied up water because she had just jumped in, got herself all cleaned off, but left this very muddy pool. And of course, as a fundraiser, the thoughts of the donor coming and actually seeing their exhibit all muddy was not the thing I really wanted to see first thing in the morning. But it's, so we're working on it. We're trying to figure it out. We've tried talking to Tellini, that doesn't work, but we are doing some conditioning work and working with the engineers to make that work a little bit better. And then lastly, if you've gone by the zoo recently, our new visitor center is under construction. It'll be open this fall. This is the Searle Visitor Center. Again, time goes by. In 1993, I believe it was, we opened up what we call the Gateway Pavilion. Maggie Daly was there to cut the ribbon. It was our first kind of visitor welcoming center. The problem was it was tremendously undersized. And so we decided to really try and accommodate, the 3.7 million visitors by creating as much bigger space, creating a nice member lounge so that people, would be encouraged to be members. And right now most membership programs are based on admission, free admission. Since we already have free admission, we have to build sort of mission-driven members. And so we're hoping that this new space will encourage people to become mission-driven members of the zoo and also just be a wonderful welcoming spot. The building also, one of the things you learn if you run a cultural institution is you never can have too many bathrooms. So we have, actually the left side of this is yet another public bathroom. So when the kids first come in for their visit, they have a place that they can stop. So this should be opened sometime in the fall, hopefully early fall. So we have a grand opening coming up in this Sunday, which you can see the details up there. And at the bottom, Mr. Kogan is helping us out with a zoo book about zoo memories. So you can log on to zoobook at lpzoo.org and give us your memories of your experiences in Lincoln Park. Maybe, you met your fiancé there, or, you brought your kids there for the first time. There's some wonderful, wonderful stories we've had, and we'd love to hear about that. So with that, I think I'll open it up to questions.
Kevin, that was just wonderful. Thank you for your presentation. Folks, we have time for some questions. So if you have a question and you've written it down, just hold it up in the air and Alex from our staff will come and pick up your question. We have several questions here that we can start with. I assume this is a legitimate person. I've never seen this name before. She says she's a City Club member. Virginia Wolf. There you are, Virginia. Okay. Virginia says, Kevin, I've been watching the black-crowned night herons building their nests at the zoo. Why do they choose such a populated, busy place?
Well, having been a bird carrier, I would tell you that birds are not the smartest of the animal species. So I'll start with that. They are colony nesters, so they're, you know, they got started here years ago. Of course, they were an endangered species, endangered breeding species within the state of Illinois. They nested down around the boardwalk early on, and then if you remember, we had to remove all the trees because they had the ash borer, and so they ended up moving north. Not only, you know, they nest in a populated area, but they do nest over our red wolf exhibit. So not the smartest thing, but the wolves like it a lot.
Very good. Excellent. This is from Rebecca Fife, who's with Landmark Pest Management. Her question is, what type of research is underway at the zoo, if any, involving rats and rodents in Chicago?
I'm not sure that we have any research going on. I mean, we have a full-time pest management person that works at the zoo, and I have to say, you know, we've actually made great strides there. Our biggest pest now, in my mind, are probably rabbits. That's probably a little bit off subject, but we have an incredible amount of rabbit damage that happens every year. So we are looking at different ways to try and control rabbit populations in a humane way. But what happens in the wintertime is they basically chew the bark around all the shrubs and trees. And I know a couple of years ago we lost about $150,000 worth of plants in one winter from rabbit damage. So that's more of a concern. I think the ongoing pest management program has been a good one for the zoo, and you know, we've been able to do well with that.
Very good. We have a couple more questions. One, you mentioned that there's no culling at the zoo. Animals that you have, you're committed to them for their entire life. What are some of the oldest, in terms of age, animals currently at the zoo?
Well, you know, I think the long-lived animals, certainly some of the reptiles. One of my favorite stories, we had a dwarf crocodile that he eventually passed away, I think, about 2-3 years ago, Megan, something like that, 5 years ago. Anyway, he was our oldest known reptile at the zoo. We called him R1 in our records. And he was about 60 years old when he produced his first offspring. So when I...
Hey, there's hope for summer.
Right. So when I'm talking to older donors, I always bring up that story. You know, I think we have, you know, if you look at great apes, for example, you know, we are very, very mindful of the fact that a lot of our chimps and gorillas, you know, they can live 50, 55 years, and they have the same kind of medical problems that we have. So we try and be very mindful. For example, in our great ape house now, you notice that there's a soft substrate. So it's a deep mulch. It's not, they don't walk on concrete because some of the older animals have arthritis, just like you and I could have. And so we try and use our knowledge about aging animals and what we can do to try and help those animals live out their lives in as much comfort as we possibly can.
Very good. Okay, this is from... Michelle, is this your question, Michelle Smith? I love your handwriting, but if I botch a couple of the words, you just tell me what you said. Of course, we love the zoo. Can you share with us your hopes and the audience, your hopes for the Lion House? Was that good?
That's good. The Colville Lion House, again, a historic building. It's absolutely beautiful. We are struggling right now to try and figure out, again, how we deal with the historic aspects of the building to maintain those but create good animal exhibits. And frankly, we know we can do, and we are going to do, a wonderful new lion exhibit on the north side that will extend the entire side of the north side of the Lion House. So it used to be lions and tigers. It'll be all lions. Inside the building, I think we're going to try and get some up-close views, so you won't have any bars anymore. It'll be looking through glass. The south side of the building are the historic old cages, and there's just really not a whole lot we can do with those. We're still in the early design process. What we have found over the years is that even if we pick species that we know don't need a tremendous amount of space, the perception that people have when they see animals in those historic cages is not a good one. And so we don't want people to leave the zoo with a bad perception that, you know, these animals aren't being well cared for or, you know, exhibiting good welfare. So, you know, we'll continue to work on that. Hopefully, we have probably another year of design work. But in the meantime, we also have about $25, $30 million to raise. If anybody has any friends out there that would like to contribute, please, I have business cards you can take one with. I'd be happy to talk to you. Okay, now trustees are giving questions. This is dangerous.
Yeah. Funny thing about asking for donations. This is from Sherry Travis. What's your current priority for improvement? In other words, what would you like us to designate for donation purposes? Now, I know you've got people from a lot of different departments here. You don't want to upset anyone, but it's a tough question.
No, it's actually not a tough question, because I think one of the great things about the zoo, and, you know, if you look at back to what I was talking about, you know, if you look at our donor base, we have people that are interested in many different things. And so we have a lot of donors that, you know, the only thing they're really interested in is this free zoo in the city of Chicago, that everyone has access to the free zoo. And that's great. There are a lot of people that, you know, that's the most important thing to them. Others, people don't even like coming to the zoo, but they love our conservation science programs, and they want to support the conservation science or the community outreach. So there's all these different pieces of it, I think, that provide people with opportunities depending on what their interest is. So we're an all-purpose organization. We're happy to take donations from any of those areas. I think you know, the conservation science department is about 80% grant funded. So I didn't mention numbers, but before we went private, we had two people working in conservation science. We now are over 40 people in that department, and that's 80% grant funded. So it does put a lot of pressure on our development staff. You know, a lot of those are five-year grants, and when those grants come up, you know, we're committed to those programs, and we're committed to the people that work in those programs. So we constantly have to find new donors. So that's always something that we're looking for new funding for.
Thank you. Now, Sarah, one of your trustees?
Yes, Sarah is a trustee.
So this is a question from Sarah Pang, who's one of the trustees. And her question is, she recalls an amazing program to vaccinate dogs in Africa to prevent rabies in big cats. So could you give us a feel for conservation work around the globe?
Sure. So that was a very, very popular program that we got a lot of very positive press on in the Tribune. We had a wonderful young researcher named Anna Saprina who was working on vaccinating dogs in the Serengeti and vaccinating the domestic dogs of the Maasai that lived around the Serengeti. And they were vaccinating for both distemper and rabies. And so what that did is, because the Maasai were living so close to the native wildlife there, A lot of the transmission of those diseases is going back and forth from the Maasai's domestic dogs to the exotic big cats, for example, living in the Serengeti. So by creating that, we basically created a vaccination ring around the Serengeti. We were able to basically stop rabies. Now, there's still some bat rabies and whatnot that have been transmitted, but we've basically been able to stop rabies and distemper in the park, and it's become a very rare event. Now, we have now found other partners to kind of continue funding that program. We started the science and started the program, but now we still are supporting it, but we're actually allowing Washington State and some other institutions to kind of bring that forward. You know, whenever we get involved in a project, we want to make sure that we can collaborate with as many individuals as possible so that we can get greater support and make sure that programs can continue.
Thank you. We have time for one more question or so. In your talk, you mentioned coyotes and beavers. I think that a lot of us have seen and recognize coyotes in the city of Chicago. Are there that many beavers in the Chicago area?
And actually, Sarah Pang sent me a video of beavers, I think it was last year or whatever, it was a couple years ago, I guess, when they first showed up at the North Pond, and I think those were trapped out. And then 2 years ago, I guess, they showed up on our nature boardwalk. And we're not quite sure how they make it to the zoo. I'm sure it's an interesting journey, but we've had several. We still have one at Nature Boardwalk. So again, our Urban Wildlife Institute, rather than catching and relocating, which is, I think, one of the things we've been advocating against with anything, with coyotes or with beavers or anything, when it's very easy to catch something up and then you move it to the forest preserve, let it go, and it's kind of out of mind. But what effect does that animal have on where you're releasing it? What diseases do the animal? There's a lot of questions involved with that. So instead, what we want to do is we want to study and we want to learn from it. So we have a beaver living at Nature Boardwalk right now. We've had to actually put fences up around a lot of the trees because they're very, very efficient at taking trees down. But it's one of those things I think you're going to continue to see those kind of things. We talked about pumas years ago. You're going to continue to see exotic animals conflicting with humans in public spaces. We've got to learn from it and learn how to coexist better. By the way, I will tell you, so when we set up these camera traps across the city of Chicago, and I looked at the pictures for the first time with our staff from the Urban Wildlife Institute, one of the first pictures we had was of a flying squirrel, and I had no idea, and none of our staff had any idea that there are flying squirrels in Chicago. And it just showed me at that point in time, I sort of came up with this idea, I said, let's go, let's look at the disease, and the good scientists on our staff said, no, wait, the first thing we have to do is find out what's there, and then we figure out how to coexist with it. And so they set up these camera traps, and lo and behold, we found a lot of species we didn't even know that we were living with in the city of Chicago.
See, Kevin, if you had grown up in the city of Chicago and not in New York City, you would have known about Rocky the Flying Squirrel.